You ready?
Yeah.
Man, it's exciting. Sat inside Mo Bobat's car. It's the cleanest car I've ever been in. Mo, welcome to the pod. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
I've never been in a car this clean. This looks like a man who deals with process and information and stuff. Do you want to explain why we're sat in your car in a car park in Leicester?
Probably gives you an insight into a character flaw and my perfectionist tendencies, or at least my obsessive compulsive nature. Is probably the best summary I can give you.
Nice. And we've touched base over the years, mainly around cricket stuff, and you've had multiple roles, more recently with ECB, and gradually I don't know whether it's called moving up in the ECB or not, but do you want to explain what it is you do? How can we have such a nice clean car?
Well, I don't have kids, that's probably why I have a nice clean car. So my role at the ECB, officially, I lead on player identification, which kind of means that, for the men's pathway, which means that I oversee scouting for the men's pathway, which is our England senior teams, men's senior teams, the Lions and the under-19s. I guess, direct our analytics that goes into identification and selection. I work very closely with selectors and inform selection decision-making. And I guess in cricket, we have a slightly different structure to other sports in that we separate coaching from selection decision-making to a degree. Work closely with coaches around player assessment, and also work very closely with counties to share and engage, I guess, in some ways, but also to benefit from their insight that they have on players. So quite a broad and varied role, centred around the sort of men's pathway, and ultimately trying to make sure that the right quantity and quality of players are picked on the pathway and into the England team so that we meet our short and medium to long term needs.
Cool. Well, that's a great answer. Mm. However, you just said something that I've never really thought about. You separate selection from coaching, so I wonder how many other sports, to some extent, I wonder how many other sports do that and why? What's the benefits?
Yeah, interestingly, so going back a few years when I was merely an England cricket fan, I never quite got my head round why we needed a selection panel. Arsene Wenger picked his own team. Why is England very different? So I kind of didn't really appreciate it. Having worked in the environment and started to, I guess, study decision-making a little bit more and weighing up the pros and cons of many of the things that impact on decision making, I definitely think it's an advisable model, actually, in that so for every stage of the pathway I described, the senior team, the Lions and the under-19s, we have a similar model in that a three-man decision making panel picks squads, and that is made up of one, the head coach, and two other independent selectors. Once the squad is selected and it comes to kind of match day, coach and captain will then lead on teams, and they can consult with the other two independent selectors if they so choose, or if they need some extra info, but they've kind of done their work prior to then. And then we kind of mirror that model at Lions and under 19 level. So you know, at the senior team, we've got Ed Smith and James Taylor as the two independent selectors, and Trevor Bayliss as the coach, as the third decision maker. And going back to your question, I think it's a really effective model because it just provides an extra layer of objectivity. It kind of removes a little bit of the emotion and bias that might exist at times without totally ignoring it, because clearly the coach's emotion is important. Of course it is, but I don't think it doesn't overplay that. And I guess my role in that entire dynamic as a fourth person is a non-decision-making support. I try and make sure that the selectors are well-informed. I check and challenge them on process, and I try and provide them with options where necessary. But I think that's quite a healthy dynamic, and it goes some way towards minimising things like conformity and groupthink and bias. Probably does a better job at us thinking about short-term and long-term decision-making needs. It relies on close communication between coach, captain, and then those other two independent selectors, and I think in general we do a good job of that.
Cool. I mean, that's the bit for me is actually so... You're almost like the 10th man in World War Z, so I'm going to draw a random analogy. However, you're the guy that three other people are looking at around selection, and actually you are going, have you thought about this? What about this? I thought we said this.
Yeah, and clearly, as with anything, where it's pressurised decision-making, I've got to be respectful in the way that I do that. And some of that might sit outside of the meeting. So it might be the prep that I do with someone like... So Ed Smith, as national selector, will chair the meeting. So it's his responsibility, not mine. And he and I might touch base beforehand and share a few ideas, and my work might get done before it. Yeah. And inside, I might just observe, or I might remind, or whatever. In other cases, I might do more than that. So it kind of varies a little bit. But yeah, if Ed and I have done some decent thinking beforehand, it minimises my need to check and challenge during the meeting, so I don't really need to.
And does Ed Smith ever talk about rooming with Rob Ashforth at Cambridge?
He has a little bit, actually. and not a huge amount, but he did tell me when I mentioned you. I think I said that you were some off-the-wall rugby coach. Who likes to think differently, which is someone that I would normally gravitate towards. He did say that he knew you through a mutual
through
friend.
Through Robbie Ash, yeah. He's a good man. What have you learned about, what's been your insight around decision making? So I think it's a significant part of sport. So your ability to select, your ability at anywhere really around decision making. What have you learned from the people around you in the last few years?
Well, I've learned a lot and I probably won't do it justice now. I think typically it comes back to being really clear on the variables that you're weighing up, because often you are. So if you're talking about decision making around young talent, you're often wrestling with current performance versus future potential, and some elements of those are easier to measure than others. If you're talking about senior team selection, you might be weighing up most likely to succeed now versus a maximum return on your investment, and you may have more or less time to give to some of those decisions based on how the team are doing and the pressure that the team are under, etc. So I just think being clear and honest with the variables that you're kind of wrestling with is a useful starting point. I think in addition to that, having real clarity on priorities. So in any selection decision making forum, you're going to get some either ors and you're going to get some comparative decisions, and having clarity on priorities or hierarchies of things that influence your decision are important. So, you know, if two players are deemed to have similar current performance, is it their future potential that outtrumps the other? You know, what is it? What's your hierarchy of things that are influencing your decision? So I think there's things like that as well. So look, there's a number of things that we've learned that are kind of, and they sound quite strategic and processing. But I guess more recently, I've learned a huge amount from someone like Ed around some of the softer elements around decision-making and selection. You know, giving thought to team dynamics and captain-coach dynamics, and when an environment might be ready for a type of decision, and getting a real temperature gauge of the changing room and things like that. And Ed's been very impressive in how that he's done that. And there'll be things that people won't necessarily see.
Yeah, I mean, I think of that from a rugby point of view. That might be around selection or someone leaving a programme, or, yeah, actually, what's the stuff that sits around that? What does the communication look like? The other thing you spoke about when we were chatting earlier that I really was curious about, and actually I really liked your language, was often performance coaches will say they're ready, or they're not ready, or they're this, or they're that, or they're not this, and they are that. Mm. So you've tried to introduce probably, let's call it a spectrum.
Yeah. So I guess I've tried to shift the dialogue a little bit there. So as most people will probably, and I'll be as guilty as anyone, you kind of fall into the trap of thinking quite a binary way. And you think that a player has it or doesn't have it, or is good enough or isn't good enough, or they've got it, they haven't got it. You know, we hear that talk all the time, and you know, and some scouts or even guys who influence that as coaches generate a reputation on being able to spot that. I just don't think it works like that in the reality, and I certainly don't think it's fair on the players. And so we've tried to embrace this concept of readiness, particularly at the guys closest to England, is where I'm talking about here. And this concept of readiness makes you think in a less binary way, because someone might be not ready yet.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite useful terminology. It might be that a player never gets ready, and that's something that you need to give thought to. And then actually, if providing him the right level of challenge and support, you can't get him ready, then that's you know, all fair and good. But readiness, I think, is a healthier way of looking at it. So we've tried to embrace this concept of readiness, to move it away from a binary element. And if we're going to invest in guys at our Lions level that are closest to England, hold ourselves accountable for how we might support that player to get more ready. Or at the end of a winter training block, you know, we've introduced, a process whereby we case conference. And during that case conference, the question I'll be asking of the room is he any more ready than he was previously? And if yes, why and where? And if no, why not?
Cool. And by case conference, I guess it's a little bit like, I might call case formulation. That would be something you would...
Yeah.
Do regularly, and I'm also curious around hold yourselves to account. So, How are the adults in the room? How are the selectors and coaches? Give me some ways that you're looking in the mirror.
I think it's fair to say that this is an area that we're exploring more recently. I think we've got some work to do to get to where I'd like us to get to on it. So I'm not gonna profess that this is a picture that we've nailed, but I think we're trending in the right direction. It takes a high degree of honesty and clearly, like any environment, a bit of psychological safety for people to front up about that. I think you need to have the right balance of objective information that can evidence progress. And in some cases where you can't evidence progress easily, you need to tap into that subjective insight as well and that expert wisdom. And I guess you embracing that concept of the wisdom of crowds, if you get the right people in the room and you have, with good facilitation, the right conversation, you should be able to narrow it down to some sort of a judgment or a collective judgment. And that takes some facilitating, obviously, during the moment. But look, in answer to your question, a combination of some of the gut feel and the subjectivity, which there's value in, some real objective insight as well, some challenging and probing questions. I think your original question around separating that type of decision-making from coaching is key, because Ed Smith and I can ask challenging and probing questions because we don't necessarily have that same emotional investment in the player.
Yeah.
And that's quite tricky for a coach. So a coach wants to build relationships with players, they invest energy in them, and they want to see the good in that player because clearly they care about their development, and so they should. All of those things are important to coaching. And therefore, sometimes it can present a challenge for coaches to give a tough judgment on that player. We've got to somehow make that safe. And we haven't quite nailed that, but I think we're getting better.
We're getting there. Yeah. What? So you're adding, and I think your language, you're adding the science to the art. So clearly you're helping support coaches with information to inform their decision-making, their coaching, their ability to get the best out of people. What's changed? So what type of stuff? And I've heard you speak a lot about your principles around talent ID. Mm-hmm. Give me, bring some of those to life.
Yeah, and often... again, just going back to this binary thought process, trying to move away from that of, for me, art is no better than science and science is no better than art. I think those two things work quite closely and interchangeably.
Yeah.
There's really good examples of where art has led our science and we've got to a good place, and there's other examples where science is having to lead our art because our art isn't quite doing what we need it to. So I think that's okay, and a bit, you know, being comfortable with that is key. So take our one-day cricket as an example. In 2015, we bombed out of the World Cup in Australia and New Zealand, not performing particularly well. And you know, I mentioned this to you earlier, that actually with good leadership from Andrew Strauss and real strategic intent, we prioritised focusing on our one day cricket, and we knew that 4 years later, and as we are now, we'd have a World Cup in this country and we needed to be in the final, if not winning that World Cup. And that gave us a level of importance, or gave it a level of importance, and we've been able to focus on that. Off the back of that, Andrew Strauss, Trevor Bayliss as head coach, Owen Morgan as captain, and also Paul Farbrace as assistant coach, got their heads together and they did the art bit of it. You know, they just lent on their own expertise. They could see what was happening around them. They huge amount of wisdom and knowledge there, and they kind of went, well, this is how we're going to get there. This might be the way we play our cricket, and this might be some of the key roles that we need. And then they mapped out literally a page and a half worth of guidance. So right, let's go about it this way. And then that kind of empowered the likes of me and others to kind of bring some of that to life, and we did some creative things around, you know, Andrew Strauss put on a North versus South series, so it's sort of almost like a sub-England level competition where we assessed players against that framework. I tried to work with all the selectors and the coaches to bring that game plan, that 1.5 pages, to life, to say, right, if that's how we want to play our cricket, what are we going to assess our players against? What's our actual criteria? We then codified that and turned that into some metrics, which would be quite useful. So an obvious example with from a batting perspective, the intent was to put the opposition under pressure in all phases and in all conditions. We wanted two strong openers that could get us off to a good start and a proactive start. That's the role that came out of the game plan stuff. Well, I was able to go and go, well, what behaviours and attributes do we want from those strong openers? Well, we want them to attack the new ball. They've got to be able to dominate the short ball. They've got to be able to clear the inner ring. Well, that means we need to look at their boundary percentage against the short ball. We need to look at their strike rate. All of a sudden, the science can come to life because we've done some good artwork. Without going into too much depth, if I flip that for test cricket, it's a lot more difficult because test cricket is 5 days long. conditions have a major impact on Test cricket game plans. So your plan in England might be very different to Australia versus India. You can't just rattle off a page and a half and expect it to work everywhere. So we're having to, and we've recently done a piece of work around our what it takes to win model in Test cricket based on different conditions, and that will probably then start to influence our art. So different in Test cricket to One Day cricket. So there's just two really obvious examples.
Yeah, and what would that? So there's a couple of questions I've got. One is, how do, has there been behavioural stuff, you know, psychological stuff, focus, let's say, that you've tried to codify? Has there been stuff that you might be quite hard to measure that you've attended to?
Yeah, very much so. So I guess we made one really obvious shift, which I think has helped us. If I go back 3 or 4 years when I first started to lead on the sort of the talent identification bit of it, we were probably like a lot of organisations interested in picking on character, like people often talk about. And we were using the sort of mental toughness traits as our model for things that we would look for. So fight, critical moment control, inner drive, etc., coping with emotions, etc., etc. And that definitely had some use and benefit to us. But the reality was, as we all know, that context binds everything. So someone might display fight in one situation but not in another, and it wasn't really reflective of that. So we, a couple of years ago, decided to shift tack slightly, and we moved to a situational based assessment approach to psychology and character. So we actually invested some time in working out which situations do we think demand mental toughness, and what might be the types of things we would see in those situations that would either be aligned behaviours or misaligned behaviours. And then it's a case of doing some training with your scouts, and they look out for those. And if enough people report on them enough times independently, it creates a picture. So an example might be, instead of having fight as a trait, we move towards, you know, how does a player respond when the opposition are being aggressive towards him?
Yeah.
What might be his aligned behaviours? What might be misaligned? Now, we don't want everyone to respond the same way, but one trigger, obvious trigger might be, is does he do what he normally does when he's at his best? And that could be individualised. So if you're Mike Atherton, it might be that you don't say anything and you absorb it. If you're Kevin Peterson, it means you go back at them. You know, whatever it is, it's fine. It can be individualised. But if we put it in the context of the situation and how the player responds, and enough people see it, it creates a picture. And I think that's been quite a healthy shift for us. So, again, it isn't an exact science. And if we embrace this concept, as I've said to you before, of aggregating multiple eyes multiple times, if people see something often enough, it creates a picture.
Cool. It reminds me a bit of that, so I'm sure you're aware, but the FA penalty project. So they actually looked at opposition players and how they took penalties, for example, when their team was 3-0 up versus they needed to get the penalty to score, and actually what were their behaviours there. It might be something we look at in rugby that might be like how you react when your team score versus when you're scored against, or all those
Very much that. And some of the others that we've got, so that was one example, the aggressive opposition, but you know, I talked about conditions earlier, but how does a player perform when conditions aren't favourable? That requires a lot of mental toughness. How does a player perform when his team are relying on a contribution from him, and there's that expectation from your peers? So look, we've got, you know, half a dozen things that we think probably, and it's a non-exhaustive list, but we've tried to identify the ones that we think are most important, and then try and capture that information from 15, 16 onwards as they go through their journey, so that by the time they get to England level, we've got a relatively robust picture.
You mentioned your scouts, so noticing would clearly be a very important skill for coaches. What type of skills are the scouts, you know, what type of noticing skills, and how are you aggregating the data from scouts? What's the stuff that's going on there that you think is leading to help support good decisions?
Yeah, and a question I often get asked is, you know, what makes a good scout? So I think that's probably not a bad player. I don't know, you didn't quite ask that, but
I'm going to ask that.
Yeah, yeah.
So hey, what makes a good scout?
It's not an easy answer, really. I'll answer it indirectly, in that there's some things that I think are important for a scout to add value, I think, in that they clearly need some level of subject knowledge expertise. So there needs to be, whatever that might be, but they need an element of that. So that could be adolescent cricket development. It could be batting or spin bowling, you know, a skill specialism. Well, when you can carve that up accordingly. But they need some level of subject matter knowledge, definitely. I look for somebody who will align to our overarching values and principles around talent. So, for example, at a young age, not overemphasising performance
yep.
at a young age, because there's a lot of noise in performance at a young age. So that kind of sort of headline values and stuff. So I look for a bit of a match there. And then beyond that, I think it's imperative, and this might sound like a really obvious one, but it's not always the case, it's imperative that the scout has an opinion, and his own opinion. And I'm very comfortable for it to disagree with the norm and the masses of the others, because actually, I see our scouts as guys that enable us to have rigorous debate. And if we have good debate, we're more likely to have rigorous decisions, I think. So I want them to have an opinion, and I'm happy if they disagree. And actually, I'll look for, in the scouting personnel that we were kind of talking through earlier, I'll try and look for diversity of perspectives. And when I say diversity, I'm not talking about necessarily race or gender. I'm talking about their relevant experiences that means they'll look through a slightly different lens.
So some batters, some bowlers perhaps,
yeah, very
some,
much so.
some people who've coached, some
guys that are currently coaching, some guys that might be playing, some guys that are newly retired, some that have played for England, some that have never played for England but have struggled on their journey and worked things out, school teachers, like just a real mix if we can, and try and get that melting pot together so we have some good debate really. And then going back to the second part of your question, how do we aggregate some of that? Well, that's a real challenge, and I think currently it's one of our strengths, in that by I guess simply the nature of the scouting reports that we've got and constructed, and the precise nature of some of our questions, you know, our scouts are able to submit reports via an app, quite a significant number of predefined questions. A lot of thought gone into question design and ratings, and you know, which questions do I want a binary yes or no answer to? Which ones do I want to scale?
Which question are you most proud of on the app?
I'm not sure there is one that I'm most proud of. I know which ones give us the best opportunity for debate, and they're the ones where you push people towards opinions and they feel uncomfortable. Yeah. And often a scout goes, well, I don't really like answering that, and I'll kind of make it safe by saying, well, I'm probably not going to make a load of decisions based off your one judgment.
Yeah.
But if 8 out of 10 people say
so
the
that
same
would
thing,
be,
that's
do you
useful.
Think he's ready versus...
Yeah, or... So to give you a good example, closest to England level, I ask about current readiness and I ask about future potential.
Yeah.
And when I talk about current readiness, I give them a bit of a binary choice of yes or no, because
yes
it's now, because actually we might have to pick him today. When I talk about future potential, you've got to accept that you're predicting slightly further away, and with time comes uncertainty. So for future potential, it might not be a binary question. I might give them I'll give them 4 options. Yeah. So there's an example of how we've really given thought to question design and etc. So ultimately, we don't have too many sort of basic text boxes for people to add stuff in, because it makes it difficult to do the thematics on that, quite simply. So try to be quite precise around how we aggregate their insight, and all of that just provides a snapshot in time or a summary over a time period of where the collective wisdom thinks about that player, and then that feeds into debate and discussion. So you know, in any given scout meeting, we'll have some objective data like their performance metrics or medical information or whatever, we'll have an aggregation of their scouting insight, and I guess I'll play the role of using that information plus the wisdom in the conversation in the room to debate and move towards some level of recommendation.
And how do you found, I mean, how often, you know, I would go into worlds and coaches would be king, and coaches wouldn't necessarily want to listen to other people, and coach knows best. What do you think it is that you've done that's allowed, you know, you guys to be having such, sound like, pretty robust, trusting conversations?
Well, I think to some degree coaches probably still are king to a degree. Might be a smaller K than other sports.
A smaller crown?
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Smaller throne, probably. that distinction I made between selectors and coaching helps, because if you're talking about selection decision making, certainly at England level, they're not king necessarily. Now, county slightly different; they're all set up with selection panels, etc. So, coaches certainly would have a more prominent role in counties, and you know, I don't have to worry too much about that. But that is a relevant element to it. Much of it's like anything, Rusty, it's relationship building and trust and showing value and having an impact and gaining people's commitment before you start providing them with that type of direction. So we haven't cracked it by any stretch, and even where we've got really good working relationships, there might still be a frustration at times because selectors and myself might want to be a bit more strategic, and naturally coaches will think, well, yeah, all that long-term stuff's good, but we've got to win games today. So there's always that battle of sort of short-term objectives versus longer-term planning, and that's quite healthy, actually. I don't think that'll ever go away. But through relationship building, gaining commitment, demonstrating impact, engaging, you know, even something as small as if you want your coaches to listen to scouts, you need to make sure that they value the scouts' opinion and they rate them, you know, because if they don't, you've already immediately got a block and a barrier. And I've seen a lot of that in other sports where there isn't necessarily that close connection between coaching and scouting, and they operate as different departments. And I've tried quite hard to bring talent ID and talent development closer together so that we don't have those challenges. And we haven't nailed it by any stretch, of course we haven't, but I think we're trending in the right direction.
You're iterating it. Yeah. What, and in terms of the iteration, what have you learned so from a young whippersnapper coaching the under-17s, managing the under-19s? What stuff have you learned, especially from the coaches? So what do you wish you'd known?
Well, I probably started... Well, firstly, I'm still learning quite a lot, so it feels quite strange reflecting back on that when I still certainly feel it, like I'm in my formative development.
Brian Ashton said the other day, and he's 73, I'm still becoming a coach, which I like.
Yeah, I was going to say, so... Yeah, so it's difficult.
You're still becoming
a... Yeah.
Still
becoming a teacher, which is where I started. I guess from my perspective, one thing that is quite obvious is there's very rarely one answer or one solution to anything. And I probably was guilty in the past of adopting quite categoric positions on things. And the more I've learned and the more I've seen, I've probably learned to embrace the chaos and the messiness a little bit more. And the key is just being less dysfunctional than your opposition, I think. Normalise dysfunctioning, and as long as you're less dysfunctional than your opposition, you've got a chance of winning, I reckon.
Yeah, people say that to me. They say, oh, that guy must be a good coach, and maybe that's it. Maybe they're just a little less dysfunctional than...
So if we all look at the All Blacks as being amazing, maybe they're just less dysfunctional than us.
Yeah.
We probably still have some dysfunction. And I think that's the same when it comes to... We're dealing with humans and human behaviour and human performance. It is going to be messy. If you think about talent and young talent, you're dealing with adolescent brains. You know, it's messy. And maybe I've learnt that, and I might still fall into impatience like others do, but I think that's helped me have a slightly different perspective. And it's why I embrace this element of art and science. It's why I embrace this as many rich information sources for decision making as possible. And you're trying to minimise the risk in your decisions, because it's never necessarily 100% right or 100% wrong. You know, you can only use the information available to you. So that's influenced me, I guess, quite heavily, really. As one answer.
Yeah, the Fletcher uses the word dynamic instead of messy and chaos. I think it sounds a bit nicer.
Mm.
And the other thing clearly I'm curious a bit about the cricket world. If Fletcher was doing this, he'd be pretty excited to be sat in the car with you, Mo. Because
I've not seen Fletcher for a while.
Cricket knows.
Yeah, he normally gives me chapter notes about his lad's cricket.
Yeah, as soon as I mentioned your name, he went down to London. I was just curious. So we've just been in the hotel. It's raining. There's going to be supposed to be a match on in Leicester. It looks like the players are in the hotel. I don't know whether it's day one or day two or what it is, but it's going to rain tomorrow. They've got a few more days in Leicester. Clearly you spent a bit of time with the teams as well. What's going on in cricket? What's the stuff that I guess is challenging as well? Because clearly, once again, some of your decisions are based around on the pitch, but I'm now starting to think, well, you spend a lot of time with people, so once again, it's human dynamics. Does that come into your reckoning? And also, you know, well, what have you noticed about cricket?
Yeah, well, the lads in this case, so Leicester, Middlesex, it's rained for 2 days and they've probably exhausted the delights of Leicester already. I don't think that would have taken them too long. It's a very relevant point. You know, when we consider England selection, the life of an England cricketer is quite bizarre in many ways. You know, I don't know exactly what it was last year, but certainly the year before, I think an England cricketer or member of management team who's involved with all formats spent something like 320 days a year in a hotel.
Wow.
You know, that's incredible when you think about it. So that takes a specific type of person, and there's a shelf life to it, because if you add on top of that, you know, obviously there's all the time away from home and all that kind of stuff. But the pressure, the scrutiny, everything that goes with touring, a bit like if you were considering someone being in the military, that's not easy, that's tough. Not everyone's cut out for that, is the reality of it. So we can't ignore that. And I guess if we go back to our pathway, at under-19 level, it's our job to start introducing them to some of those challenges. So touring's important, and putting enough support around them so they can... they can be energised by it and enjoy it and look forward to it. And because at that age, it's just exciting and it's brilliant. You know, you're in Dubai for 4 weeks, or you're in Australia for four weeks. It's brilliant. So, but also get them used to spending time away from home and knowing how they would fill their time, and all that kind of stuff is important. And certainly at Lions level, it might be us ramping up the pressure a bit more scrutiny. But we need to observe quite closely how people do operate off the park. Do they give to the environment and the team, or don't they? So that's the team bit of it. But also, like, their own individual coping mechanisms. And in some cases, we've got to add some extra support on there to help them thrive in that environment. So that's tricky. So, yeah, in essence, we have to pay attention to that. And going back to this dynamic of coaching versus scouts and data and all that kind of stuff, that's where we rely really heavily on what coaches observe. When we take players away in the winter, they observe quite closely. They spend time having dinner with these guys, you know, overnight and all that kind of stuff. And everything we sort of glean from that is really important for when we eventually pick England teams, when we need people to tour Australia for 4 months to get hammered by the Australian public, have some difficult challenges on the field, have all the commentators on Sky attacking your technique and everything else that goes with that. And then not spending any time with your family. You know, it's quite a bizarre existence. So, look, in answer to your question, it's of paramount importance, and we need to do as good a job as we can at understanding that. And more recently, you know, work that's been led by David Young, our sort of psychology lead, and also some of the work we've done with an organisation called Changing Minds, trying to better understand the sort of the high performance psychology stuff around, I guess, personality types and, you know, what type of individual will look to thrive in that type of environment. And it might be a narcissist and the guys that we were probably overlooking and ignoring before. But at the same time as that, also, what can the system do to enable that person to thrive? You know, and not just thinking that it's everything that the player or the athlete needs to do. What can the system do to support them? And, you know, and the guys at Changing Minds have done some great work with us at helping us to understand that, and, you know, embedding that is really important.
Well, yeah, I was just, because we obviously just sat in the hotel there for an hour or so, and the whole time, because there's no cricket on, people are talking about the players, and I mean, the scrutiny is, you know, I mean, if there's no cricket for 5 days, they might just talk about the players for 5 days.
Absolutely, yeah. And if you're in a bad run of form, it's time to overthink about it. Even if you're in a good run of form, it's time to overthink, which probably isn't that helpful. So it can be tricky. And, you know, like I said, I don't have a county role, so I don't have to worry about English weather too much in that regard, even though I've overseen under 19 series at home, and you kind of get bits of that. So I guess my experience more lends itself to when we're overseas in the winter. You know, I've done an under 19 tour as manager of the group when we went to Bangladesh for a World Cup, and we spent 5 weeks under real heavy security, you know, literally ground or hotel, nothing else, you know, with 18 and 19 year olds. And as it happens, a decent hotel, the lads did a great job at thriving in that environment. But yeah, that was tough. Even from a staff perspective, we did quite a lot of preemptive work around self-awareness as individual members of staff. Kind of, you know, James at Changing Minds has got this mantra which has kind of stuck with us around, make sure you put your own oxygen mask on first before you try and think about your players. And that's kind of stuck with me around, got to make sure the staff are in a good place, because if the staff are in a good place, the players will be. So he's helped us quite a lot. We've done some stuff around buddying up as staff members. You know, knowing what each other are like on a good day and when we're struggling, having an outlet, giving people rest periods, because ultimately if the staff are in a good place, that will transpire onto how the players are.
Yeah, well, that'd be cool. We definitely did a lot of that stuff with Sevens, and take Uno with you. What's your favourite movie?
Oh, favourite movie? Random question.
Mine's just give you a bit of thinking time. Mine's Forrest Gump.
Is it? Why?
Yeah, I just think it's beautiful. Favourite TV programme, 63 Up.
My favourite TV programme is probably The Office.
Oh, nice. Yeah. What's your favourite movie?
Difficult. I don't think I have a favourite movie. There's all sorts of movies I like.
I knew you'd have to, but it depends. It's context.
Yeah, it's a little bit. It depends what mood I'm in.
Happy mood.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll say that for the next podcast.
Nice. Any resources, any areas you could point coaches or people listening towards that you think would be useful? Any stuff that's helped you? Books?
Well, I'd say ultimately there's ideas and concepts everywhere. You've got to hunt them.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you have to look that hard. I feel really, really, I guess, fortunate that I had 7 years as a teacher before I worked in professional sport or sort of elite sport. And so much I take from my time as a teacher that's helped me be effective in my role, I think.
Yeah, but...
And some really obvious connections, like, you know, we've spent some time recently talking about things like talent development frameworks, and you know, there's some obvious answers out there around how people acquire language or how people learn how to write, you know, like learning your spelling before you put words and sentence structure together, and hierarchy of learning, and all that kind of, there's stuff everywhere around you, whether it's you, your family, your kids, what you see on TV. So look, I don't think you need to look that hard. There's some obvious answers around you, and I feel quite fortunate that I've learned a hell of a lot from having been a teacher that I can sort of transfer over to here, that I guess at times enables us to think that the problems aren't specific to cricket, you know, as you often think at times. Yeah, well, yeah. Rugby's different.
And you would have experienced as a teacher what lots of those kids are experiencing in school, so that would help you as a coach or a,
yeah, it gives you a little
someone
bit of that,
running a program.
Yeah, a bit of that empathy as well. So I'd say, in answer to your question, there's learning everywhere, and I certainly try and pride myself on looking around as much as I can to keep learning, and some obvious things are around you. Look, I do like reading. I'm a slow reader, so it takes me quite a long time to read a book, mainly because I like to reread and make notes, and I often don't leave myself long enough either, so it's normally flights that I do some reading on.
Top book. What's your favourite book? Sapiens is mine.
Is it?
Yeah, I love it. I think it's beautiful.
I'm not long ago read The Undoing Project. I really enjoyed that.
Okay.
Really good, and much of my, I guess, philosophy from a player ID perspective can be summarised in a lot of what you hear there, so I think that's an excellent book. From a leadership perspective, I quite like a book called Insanely Simple, which is about...
Well, you're just giving me, I mean, this is...
Yeah, it's I guess
you're helping Amazon. Amazon share price has just gone up.
It's a second-hand account of Steve Jobs' leadership, and it centres around simplicity, which I think is really good. And some of it's a little bit anecdotal, but you know, if you look past that, there's some really good messages around how we can overcomplicate things, and how simplicity is key from a leadership perspective. So I think that's good. And then I'll give you one more, very different now. Blood and Sand, Frank Gardner, inspirational.
Mate, seriously, three books I've never even heard of.
BBC security correspondent, working out in the Middle East, got shot loads of times, in a wheelchair.
Don't ruin it,
incredible perspective on life.
Right. Mate, on that, it's been a pleasure hanging in your car.
My car's a bit steamy now. I don't know if it's my hot air or yours.
It's definitely mine. Mate, really appreciate your time. We'll definitely do another pod.
Favourite film? I'll give it some thought.
Yeah, we'll start with that, and then, you know, we'll see how you guys go over the next few months. Hope it goes well. My fingers are firmly crossed, hoping all the hard work you've put in will pay off.
Yeah, hopefully next time I see you, we're World Cup and Ashes winners.
Nice, in the back seat.
New car.
Cheers, dude.
Cheers, mate.
Bye.
Thank you, mate.